Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
This program is made possible thanks to the generosity of our listeners. Show your support at heritageradionetwork.org/donate.
You're listening to Item 13, an African food podcast, and I'm your host, Yom Akuaku. Every week, we'll delve into the delicious world of African food, including chefs, curators, and bloggers. Here's the show.
Okay, so this week I'm excited to bring to you a wine expert. Those of you who've listened to this podcast for a while know that I'm big on wine. Although I don't think I've told you this, Kojo, but I've given up drinking for the rest of the year. So I'm missing this. We'll see how this conversation goes in terms of bringing me back around. But I haven't had wine in a while. And so we'll see how this goes in terms of that. But I'm excited to talk to Kojo, one, because we have a lot of things in common in terms of background, being from Ghana, specifically both being Ewe. And then we both also worked in banking, it sounds like, and also have deep interest in wine. So all of that brings us to this conversation today. And I wanted to kick it off by asking you to introduce yourself to the audience, who you are. I think I've given a little bit of a hint in terms of where did you grow up, a little bit about yourself.
Okay. Well, thank you so much. My name is Kojo. Obviously, I go by Wine Kojo on Instagram. Mm. Originally from Ghana. And still from Ghana, born, bred, and buttered in Ghana. I grew up here in Ghana, and I moved to the U.S. Like a week before I started college. Went to school in Virginia. Went to school after that, grad school in Chicago. Worked in banking for a long time, 16 years.
Oh wow!
Yeah. On the trading floor. So,
oh my God, that's intense, actually.
I'm a quant on the trading floor, on the desk. My degree was in financial mathematics. So most of what I did was did models on the trade floor, particularly related to commodity trading. So at some point in my journey, I just got, you know, I felt sort of confined. I wasn't getting... You know, my soul wasn't there, or I wasn't getting the traction that I wanted there in banking. So I got bored on the trade floor. That movie Som came out, and not before that. Before that, there was Sideways. That
oh yeah, I remember Sideways.
Yes, yeah, so I actually did that whole trip at some point. The movie, you know, when they went from L.A. All the way north, I've done that at least two or three times, that trip, because it was very interesting to me. So I just started picking up and learning. And then when Som came out, I decided to just try my hands at it. It was a bet with some of the guys on the trade floor. So I went, studied, took the exam and passed. And then applied after that, obviously, is what I do. once I finish something, it's like, what is next? So I'd applied to go to Italy to this academy where I just found it, just Googled it. I thought it was interesting. It seemed pretty tough to get into, but I got into it, long story short. Even my teacher was surprised that they accepted me. And when I got there, I understood why, because of the 50 people, I was the only one who didn't work in wine. I was a banker.
Oh.
Yes. But the truth is, the teacher was also Italian who grew up in Canada and who had spent considerable time in the medical field. He was a gastroenterologist and at Harvard Medical. He decided, listen, I'm going to just go back. He went back to Italy, started walking the vineyards, talking to the wine growers and the wine producers, and wrote a very thick book, like a 700-page book.
Oh, wow.
And this became the textbook that you needed to read and pass the exam. And this guy took pride in making things very difficult. and the Agata. But the truth is, there was a certain pride in what he did. And, you know, he always came at it from a very scientific place because he was a trained physician. You know, that helped me a lot because I came from physics. I was a physicist in my
I see. Study.
So for me, it forms structure in my mind. I like structure before I like to get creative. So that worked great. So went to Italy, was 50 of us took the exam. Of the 50, 22 of us passed. And I was one of them. And, you know, my name, because it starts with the A, the last name, I was the first one to be mentioned. And I was just screaming, ran up to the stage and got my pin. But it was a huge start in this wine.
In the wine thing.
That's right.
So that's
my and then later left the trade floor and went to Yale to study to get an MBA. And wine played a role in getting me in. And literally when I walked into the interview, the admissions director said, "Oh, you're a wine expert?" And I said, "Yeah." She said, "This interview is over." you know, I got into Yale. I obviously did very well at Yale academically, but largely wine has made me a lot of friends. And
I can imagine. I can imagine.
With.
Yeah. So, wow, there's a lot to unpack there. So, one, I want to go back. I'm going to rewind all the way back to when you were on the trade floor and, you know, between Somme and Sideways. Had you had wine before then? So, like, I can understand, unless you're just a super highly motivated person, because to go from being inspired by those couple of movies to immersing yourself completely into this world of wine, I wonder if you'd had, you know, any experience with wine before then?
It's a great question. So sometime in my career, I lived in Omaha. And
Omaha, well, okay.
Omaha, Nebraska. I worked for Conagra in Omaha. And
I see.
The company gives you all these perks when you go. So I had such cheap interest rates and I bought a huge house. I was in my mid-20s. So I didn't know what to do. The house was largely empty other than like my couch and the bed and the guest room.
Right.
So it was empty. The shelves were empty. And I had some friends visiting. They're like, "Hey, maybe you should just collect wine." You know, but before then, like anything I do, I try to find structure. The moment I found out that within wine, all the things that were saying, the strawberry and the blackberry taste and the blueberry, and all that was not actually put in there. The moment I found that out, I was obsessed with discovering those things, right? So I think I had gotten to the point where largely I could tell the difference between Merlot and Cabernet. And in America, that's, I always tell people in a lot of cases, wine from California is a blend between those two. In Bordeaux, especially, you get a blend of those two or some proportion. I tell people, if you can tell the difference between Merlot and Cabernet, you're right on your way to bring your palate to understand what you're doing. Then after that, I moved on to Pinot Noir. So I think before these movies, I was able to comfortably be able to tell you the difference just tasting them.
Merlot
and Cabernet, and obviously Pinot Noir, which is very obvious from the eye. Like, you can see it. The other ones, you can't always see them clearly as far as what.
Yeah, and we'll talk about that later. We'll do a little bit of wine education later so that people can. Because wine, I think, in terms of approachability, sometimes can be a little bit difficult because people hear, you know, when you start talking about, you know, the different types and alcohol content legs, you know, Pinotage versus a Pinot, Merlot versus a Cabernet, and people just get like, it almost seems like it's exclusive, it's elitist almost. And so the approachability there can be a little bit challenging. So a little bit later, I want us to do some education on like basics. What should you be looking for in a wine, etc. And then in terms of the rewind, one other question I had was around specifically Italian. Like, why were you drawn to Italian wine and to becoming certified in that space? Was it because of the challenge of that program, or?
Yeah, no, it's an interesting question. And that comes out of, you know, when I sat there, I had questions, and I, you know, it goes back to some of what you said, which is that for a long time, wine had been presented as an elitist thing. And here I wasn't in wine. It was a banker and all that and doing well, but I didn't want to be associated with that. And also for me personally, the history of the French involvement in Africa, I have a preference for non-French things. So I had a choice between France and and Italy is as far as the specialization. But I felt that there was a few things. I mean, I spent time in Italy. I had family in the Treviso area who had lived there since the 80s. I'd visited them a few times. So I could do a direct connection. Italians are much like Africans in their response to things. They're fiery and not organized. But in there, you get an opportunity, if you're not a certain kind, to get in there. You know, I could go to Italy today and sit there and study one grape and become the foremost expert in the world on that grape. Because unlike France, which literally produces wine from about 15 grapes, Italy actively produces wine from about 435 grapes.
Oh, wow.
So not only that, but there's 2,000 grapes out there that are there. So I could take any of them and just the love and the passion for it become, you know, the respected expert in that.
Right.
I like that opportunity. I like the going-ness of Italian life, so to speak. And that you didn't have to belong to certain family to you know, Italy largely. And then as I dug deeper and deeper and studied into it, wine is food in Italy. It was never a bourgeoisie thing. And not only that, it's not Italy is not one country. It never was until 1865 when they clubbered a bunch of regions together, right? So to form this country we know today as Italy. So largely, if you came from Piemonte and you were drinking Barolo, and then you went to Sicily and where they're drinking Nerello Mascalese, and you tell them, oh, here's a fancy Barolo, they're going to look at you like, what the hell is that? Because largely, the wine is connected to their food. So this is one of the ways that Italian wine is so structured. If you told me what village you're in and what town you're in Italy, chances are I can almost tell you the wines you'd be drinking there.
Interesting.
Yeah, because wine is regional, wine is food, wine is local in Italy because, you know, there's a tradition there, which is what it's supposed to be largely.
And so I want to take us now from Italy to South Africa, which is where sort of African wine industry or culture is concentrated. And I see on Instagram, at least, that you've been to South Africa a few times and wanted to get your take on the, I guess, the landscape of wine there. So wine industry, the cultural and political backdrop. So I lived in South Africa for a couple of years. And I would say that those 2 years were probably when I indulged in wine the most because it was so cheap and good. I thought I actually have a preference for South African wines now. So I wanted to get your take. So for those that are listening, just based on your experience with, I guess we can compare with Italian wines. What would you say, how would you contrast that with South African wines, for example? And then in terms of a cultural, I guess, backdrop or...
So I had a good time in South Africa in the wine industry. I will say mixed time, not necessarily because of time, but because of the culture and the backdrop around it. So for me, my experience when, again, for me, wine is a vehicle, right? Wine is an expression of a place, a culture. So I'm very keen on terroir, which is what the French have pushed, and thankfully, so that we're not confused by you know, people who pretend to be things, right? Then that if you're producing, of course, if you're producing champagne in Epernay or Rhône, then you should be champagne. And if you're producing in California, you should be called sparkling wine, right? I like that because then we you know, at least let's know. It's almost like the difference between American who grows up in Southern California and the ones who grows up in Mississippi, in Hicksburg.
Yeah.
There's gonna be cultural nuances and difference. You know, at least if nothing else, the barbecue is gonna be different.
Yeah.
So you want that to be expressed, right? So in that regard, I totally appreciate what South Africa presents. It's a new world. So you get a lot of, vibrancy. You get a lot of, you just edge, right? You're edgy. Mm-hmm. Not a lot of, you know, there's a long history, but none of it compares to the old world that has, you know, some, all these structures and rules and things that have been in existence for years. So in that regard, South Africa was revealing and interesting. You know, for me as a, you know, as an African who's a Italian wine ambassador and who studied wine greatly, I will wish that African wine space was a little more welcoming of me. But obviously, Africa has its very dark history. And
right.
I feel more welcome in the wine industry in Italy than I do in the wine in South Africa.
I can see that too. And I think a lot of to be frank, and you know, like a lot of the wine industry in South Africa is spearheaded by white South Africans, right? And so you find more Black South Africans either working in the vineyards or if by virtue of economic or labor laws, they have some sort of quota, they would have some people working in the wine rooms as service, etc. But you don't see Black South Africans sort of at the forefront of the industry.
Yeah, I mean, I attend a wine conference in Italy every year. Invariably, most of them, when they find out that I studied under Ian De Agata and I actually know the grapes and know what I'm talking about, invariably somebody says, hey, there's a vineyard, do you want to buy it, right? Because, you know, largely in what is supposed to be mostly human, if you come to us and you accept us and you accept our people, then we welcome you amongst us, right? You accept our traditions, then they make me feel at home in Italy. when I go and they offer me a vineyard, like, you should do, you know, because it's one of these things in the world that is meant to be shared. And if you have it, you know, it's almost like chocolate, you know, it's better shared, you know, you don't preserve chocolate for a certain kind of people. The joy of it should be shared. And I feel the same for wine. And I hope that in South Africa, over time, I mean, I have participated in the industry, and I can count less than 10 black producers in South Africa in 2020, yeah. Right? Less than 10 that I know, and maybe a few that I am yet to discover, but I can count all of them that I know. And it's not for trying, right? It's not for it's that. You know,
yeah. And I mean, yeah, I think I explored in the time I was there, I explored quite a bit. And I don't remember ever meeting a black producer. So yeah, I was introduced to a couple of people.
I had to find them online. I had to find a lot of them. And then I try to represent them in the West African market as much as I can. Obviously, you know, so, you know.
Yeah, that's unfortunate. Yeah, but I guess that's it, what it is. So then let's talk about your Africa Wine Club. Since we're talking about African wine now, I'm sure it's not focused on African wine, but why the wine club? Like, what's the purpose? And then for anyone that's listening that wants to join, how do they get to join the party?
Yeah, so it's Africa Wine Club. So it for me, it means that Africans who enjoy wine. So it's Africans here and in the diaspora. So not necessarily African, but Africa Wine Club.
Yeah.
So the goal of it is just to bring people together really naturally. So the tagline of our organization is food, culture, and business, right? You know, it's the goal is that the wine leads it. It would lead us to food invariably. The food will lead us to culture and discovery and learning about each other. And then after that, we can do business together in some So that's really the goal of the Africa Wine Club. It started really well here. Naturally, because of the economics of wine, it attracts a certain kind of people.
Right.
So my goal is to harness this group for change, for things that we want to see. Okay, let's all drink wine, and then let's talk about the things we can do together to make everybody's life better. That's the goal.
And then, so it sounds like it's an in-person, well, in this COVID world, but before COVID, it was an in-person, you're meeting in person, you're tasting, trying new wines.
Exactly. And we still are largely, we're here in Accra, we're growing. The goal is to expand to other African cities. The goal is that if you live in Accra, you go to Abuja or Lagos, and somebody's a club member, whether from your own private collection or from a wine bar or a wine restaurant, you can connect, right? And then, so one other reason where if you are doing business in Accra from Abuja or from in Abuja from Accra, you wouldn't feel like a stranger because we all have something in common. And it doesn't have to be something religious or tribal or...
Yeah.
<you know? laughs> So that's the goal of it. And our website is going up soon. I've been building up from the ground and
actually
it's been going well. And it makes it so we're not... You know, for me, because I import wine now, I'm not beholden to some store or somebody to outlet my wine. I go directly to these members because I want to get to know them. And that's what it's all about. It's not about the wine. It's about everything else that comes with it.
Yeah. And I had a question for you. I think it's sort of related to the wine club, but also maybe not. it's around groups and wine. So traditionally, or in my experience at least, the congregation of people around wine for activities is largely attributed towards women. So it's women who get together to do book clubs around wine or like wine tastings. Or do you find in your experience with Africa Wine Club that you have a, what's the mix in terms of gender? And is it, I guess if it's more co-ed, then it's a little bit more. But do you find men, I always find it interesting that men in the wine space tend to be the experts, but you don't find men doing wine socially, like in groups.
Yeah, it's an interesting observation, and that's largely correct, right? That observation. And so when we do event, it's targeted towards women. Naturally, they're the ones who come out for those events. But when I do the personal drop-offs, it's to the men. They buy the 10 boxes at a time, and
but they're drinking in private.
That's right, they're drinking in private. But then the future of this is to have presentations and things that appeal to men. But these are largely successful men who might not care for all the other stuff. But of course, they could benefit a lot of people who come there. So it's interesting. Even those, a lot are initiated by women, right? Their wife is the one who contacts me. And then the
relationship
ends up being built with the final consumer, who's the husband and stuff like that. But largely, yes. So when we do events, we have planning events coming up that is going to be in a museum, the very fancy museum here in Accra. I was just recently built, and 80% of that number is gonna be, women.
That is really so interesting to me, because I think men socialize around alcohol. I don't know if there's an idea that wine is feminine, because men will go out and do, like, they feel comfortable saying they're going out for beer with the guys, for example, or if, depending on certain social classes, men will do cigar parties, or they probably wouldn't call it parties, but they will organize around food or drink. But like wine, for whatever reason, because I have a lot of guy friends that will drink wine, but I don't see them going out specifically
That's changing. That's changing largely. In our parts, it's class signaling.
I guess.
So in our part, if you came out for wine, depending on the setting and what have you, it means you're a certain kind of income bracket or whatever, right? Or that if you understand wine, then it means you're there's a certain level of sophistication. And just generally, what we present to men is that, black people, we consume a lot of cognac, right? We're 80% of black people everywhere in the world, 80% of cognac production, right? For me, then I make that connection. If you like cognac, then it's okay to like wine, because cognac is made from wine, right? So it's that connection. It's that, hey, maybe I should get older. You should stop drinking this hard stuff right away.
Yeah.
Just start with wine, and then, you can do a nightcap with cognac, but you should enjoy your environment more and not just go hard right away. So there's signals that you can send that indicate that. But men also largely have a fridge in their offices. Wine, right? In Ghana here, It looks sophisticated. If somebody comes to your office and it's a Friday afternoon at 3 p.m., that, you can offer them water and tea, and then sparkling or red or white, it seems a cool thing to do. So in those settings, men are gladly running for it. But yeah, in the social setting, in an event in a museum, chances are you're gonna a lot of ladies. So
maybe we should be pouring the wine into scotch glasses and it looks
we
less.
We could.
Less feminine. Okay, before we take a quick break, yeah. I wanted to touch on something you've been doing on Instagram since, I'm thinking it's since COVID started. It's this virtual wine tasting that I've seen you do with a couple of different individuals. And I think that's actually, so what got me thinking about women, that there's a lot of women who will openly, like, you know, do this sort of thing. But that's, could you talk a little bit about that so that if people are interested, they can tune in? Or is it a regular series you're doing or just?
So it was interesting, so I helped the Wine South Africa group when they, you know, that's what took me to South Africa. And then when obviously they couldn't move, COVID and all that, the lockdown in South Africa was very severe. You couldn't do anything, no exports. So literally wine of South Africa was like, okay, how are we going to stay relevant? How are we going to stay in people's minds? So we had a conversation and they sent a few wines and they wanted us, they had themes every month, and they wanted us to, in all the regions, in East Africa as well, just educate people. And generally, women are early adopters in a lot of things, right? So it was an easy layup to get a lot of women to participate. It turned out to be a great success. And then as a result, so one of the things I'm doing, I'm sure we'll talk about it when we close, is, when we do rapid fire, is, so I'm starting my own label in
oh,
yes. So, I found enough success doing that, that I feel like when the first batch of my own label comes out here, in about a month, I'll be.
Oh, wow. That's soon here.
Yes. I've been working on it for a few months now. They've been delivered to the shippers. So significant progress in that regard. So it's going to be useful to get people interested. It's much like the format that you have, but very short. I don't go beyond 5 minutes. I want to keep people's attention very quickly.
Yeah.
Do a bunch of them. I don't want to belabor the point. Some people were very mad. I kept it very short. But it worked. It allowed people to feel like, okay, this is not complicated. I can do this. And that was a good thing. So it was largely sponsored by the Wine South Africa group. But
I see.
Anyway, yeah.
Got it. Okay. Cool. All right. So we will take a quick break here. And then when we come back, we will have what I'm calling a crash course in wine. So for anyone that's intimidated by, wine, you can't get into it, we'll do high level, the basic things you need to know, whether it's at a restaurant or if you go into a store, what to know what to get. We'll be right back.
All of us at HRN have been keeping busy, despite working and recording from home. This fall, we're proud to announce new shows on the network that each bring important and enlightening stories to listeners around the world. While the world is in turmoil and the future of our country is uncertain, there are certain constants that help keep us going. For us, food and storytelling are essential. While we can't come together in person, food podcasts from HRN provide a virtual table we can all gather around. Bringing exceptional stories to your ears and keeping you informed on the ever-changing political and environmental issues of our time is integral to our mission. At a time when the world around us is rapidly changing, HRN is committed to being here for our listening community, and we need you to be here for us. Join our table and help ensure the future of food radio by becoming a member of HRN. Go to heritageradionetwork.org/donate to make a contribution. Check out the latest additions to our lineup while you're there. You can see all of our series at heritageradionetwork.org/new show.
We're back from the break. We're going to do a crash course in wine. And actually, during the break, we kept chatting. And maybe that's the first question for you, what we were just talking about. So how do people, first of all, in your experience, get introduced to wine before we sort of dive into the different kinds of wine?
Yeah, even before people taste wine, even before people ever have a first taste of wine, their first introduction to wine here in Africa, because the truth is, wine grows at latitude 30 to 50 degrees north and south. And this is why wine grows in the very northern part of Africa, and then in the very southern tip. Obviously, some parts of the east, Ethiopia, the Rift Valley, and then the Rift Valley of Kenya, Ethiopia, you know, they have some wines growing there. I mean, Ethiopia has a long history of Christianity and wine and communion, right? But most people come to wine, at least hearing of it, from the Christian faith here in Africa.
That's so interesting to me. I've never made that connection.
Yes, so that's their very first time. So they think, you know, Jesus said, this is my blood. So the wine has to look like blood, right? It has to be dark, right? It has to have the consistency of blood, the thickness almost, the color. So it has to be dark, and it has to taste like a grape, as in what they heard in the Bible, right? So based on that, I've been able to piece together what people generally like here. And this is how I formed my own label. That is informed by, so my label is not a, you know, my wine club members drink some more sophisticated grapes and a variety, but the masses largely drink wines that fit what they believe the exposure to this is, and which largely is from their Christian experience.
That is so interesting to me. Wow. So it's mostly red. Mostly red wine then. Slightly sweet or sweet.
Yes, they swear by red wine. They say white wine is not good. Most people will swear by red wine, and when it's red, it has to be red. It has to be dark. It has to be fruit forward, because that's
That's interesting. Okay, so let's talk about red wines and white wines. What's the difference? We'll start from the basics. What's the difference between, generally speaking, a red wine and a white wine?
So it's very interesting. The grapes, you know, the one that looks white is white. The one that looks red is red, right? Just generally, right? But both inside is white. So if you take those grapes, you see, you've seen them somewhere, right? In pictures, whatever, brochure. Whether the skin looks red or the skin looks white, what is inside is always going to produce white wine, right?
That makes sense.
Yes, what makes red wine is the skin of the red wine, right? So then they leave the skin in the juice, and that's what produces red wine. So that's really the basics of it.
Yeah. And then how do you start then to get the differences in like red? So how do you go from a Cabernet to a Merlot to a Pinot Noir, I guess, specifically?
So, you know, there are different varieties of grapes. Like I said, in Italy, there's at least 2,000 that are recorded.
Right.
So over a lifetime, obviously such a thing as wine, where it's been so many years of making money from it, you're going to get varieties. Because like anything, if you were born an African that grew up in Siberia versus an African that was born and raised in Accra, have very different, even though the genetics are the same, they'll have very different upbringings and adaptations, right? So when you go to your grocery store, you see very many varieties of, of apples, for example. And, you know, especially when it's apple season, especially in the Midwest and all these places where apples grow, you're going to see so many varieties. So that's just your difference between Merlot and Cabernet. Now, certain things do better in certain places, right? You're better off growing oranges in Florida than in Maine and Vermont. So, you know, that's what you call terroir. That means there's environments that fit certain things better, right? If you're a tennis player, you know, if you're Serena Williams, you live in Florida because you get a lot of good weather to play tennis.
Yeah.
Whereas if you lived in Maine or Vermont or in Alaska, you might not, I mean, be able to get as much outdoor tennis to play.
Okay, so then when we think about, I want to go into pairing with food.
Yeah.
And then I think we'll start to think about how then we choose wine in that way. So generally speaking, what characteristics of wine should we think about? And this is, I'm just saying this because we don't have, you know, this is not we don't have video here to show people specific wines to show. So in general, like what characteristics should we be thinking about when we think of wine? And are these characteristics put on the label? So things like when you say wine is fruity or it's like oak, you know, it has, you know, hints of oak, for example, what do those things mean in terms of our food? And I think probably the best way to do that is for me to name some foods. And then you tell me what characteristics, and I know this is generally speaking, there's, so taking a step back, generally a general rule, which people have come to debunk, is that mostly heavier foods, red meat and that sort of thing goes with red wines, and then like fish and those sorts of other like more like, I guess, acidic foods you do with white wine. But over time, people have been, it's become more of a fun art, let's say, versus a strict science.
That's very true. And I agree, you know, I agree with you. There's no science to that. Because in red wine, there's a lot of spectrum. You can imagine a rosé, right?
Right.
A rosé, most people would say it's more white wine-ish, right? A rosé is just largely, in most cases, a red grape that they dip the skin in the, you know, in 3 days instead of 3 months, right? You know what I mean? So you don't get as much color, right?
Right.
Rosé is largely, for the most part, you know, a lot of it comes from red wines, right? Red grapes. So that's to say, the common denominator there, the things to look for, is that wine, white wine, has what we call acidity. It's almost like you went to a restaurant, they serve you salmon, and then they put that lime on the side or lemon on the side.
Right.
That's acidity. You're using the acidity to balance the fishy taste, right? So white wine largely has acidity. And this is what people make the connection, right?
Yeah.
There's red wines that have acidity, right? you know, and they're different degrees of acidity, but mostly present in white wines and how they're made. So this is why they say it goes with fish. And that's
right.
Right, that's a good thing. Red wines have what you call tannins. Tannins are those things that break up. If you're eating a steak and you get all the fat and all that, if you just need a balance, something to break off this constant meaty, oily, fatty taste, this is what tannins do. Tannins break up that continuum, meaty, fatty. So this is why people make that connection. Beyond that, you have to explore. And the beauty of it is exploring. I always tell people, and this is somehow in my wine discovery, I just kept tasting, trying different things. One day I was cooking some chicken. And then I drank this wine when I was living in Chicago, I think. And I drank this wine. And then before I cooked the chicken, then when I cooked the chicken, I started eating the same wine. I just so evolved and it was so beautiful, you know, paired so beautifully with the chicken that I made. It was a basil chicken that I made. So that, you know, those moments make all this experience worthwhile. Anybody who's gotten there. One day, my brother called me from Atlanta and says, hey, I had this wine. Oh, my God. You know, because that wine just paired beautifully with the food. And he, all of a sudden, you get it when that happens. It's like this eureka moment. So, you know, those are the considerations.
Yeah, there's a lot of experimentation for sure. And I think for me, like we talked about it to being, you know, wine culture in general being considered classist or elitist sometimes just because of the price point, especially in our part of the world. I guess if you start by those general rules, and then as you try different things, you can start to see, like you discovered, for example, as you were making chicken, you'll start to see what pairs best versus not. But wanted to just do a couple of examples of, like, broad strokes, some foods that you may not find generally in, like, Western types. So, like, fermented foods, for example. Like, if I was having kenke or injera, for example, is there, like, what sort of notes or characteristics that if I picked up a wine bottle, maybe I would find on the label that, you know, you think would go with that?
Yeah, so I find that in fermented foods, banku, kenke, they go well with, I find personally, and this is an interesting thing when you drink wine in the West and they tell you all these fine, neat box things in, and then you come to the continent and the food is more, if you had okra soup here, okra soup is evolved in New Orleans to be like gumbo and stuff, right? And gumbo and all that, right? It almost seems to be our food. And if you ate any of that in New Orleans, it's a mixture of sausage and crabs and Latin.
Right.
So it's the same here. If you eat your regular run of the meal okra soup here, made well, it has fish, it has meat, it has shrimp, and it has greens, right?
Yeah.
Everything is working in there. And it depends on whose hand made
exactly. That's a good point.
What the emphasis is on, because you could go and you start pairing it with the goat meat that is there. But the one that made the fish more dominant in that.
Right. Story. Yeah. Yeah.
So, largely, when it comes to fermented foods, I find. Like very light wines do the trick. So a Pinot Noir or a Lambrusco, right, has a little bit of acidity, a little bit of tannins, and they largely would balance you out and give you a really nice pairing. So yeah, it's interesting. A lot of the rules are thrown out when you
come. Exactly.
And fries, right?
Yeah. And then what about, so again, broad strokes, like spicy tomato-based stuff. So like stews or like soups.
So, you know, over there, your Merlot is great. Even your white wine, your Riesling is great. You can go into certain kinds of Chardonnay and that could work. The Chenin Blanc, even a Sauvignon Blanc would be good.
I hope people are taking notes. So those who are, especially for newbies who want to, you know, try new things, this can be, again, like we're saying, these are just suggestions. As you try to experiment, you may find different ways. And especially because our food is not very regimented in the way it's made, it depends on who's making it and what they want to focus on. So
yes. And then and with that as well, Chianti is good for anything tomato-based.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then lastly, like, there's a lot across the continent, because everybody I've interviewed across the continent, concentrated in West Africa, but I found in East Africa too, and even in Northern Africa, like peanut stews and sauces. So like soup heavily based around like ground peanuts or groundnuts, as we call them. What would you say?
Yes, I find the fruit forward wines to be really great. So in the world, your pinotages, New World, Merlot, anything with a lot of sunlight, your Shiraz from Australia or South Africa, or your Primitivo, honestly, from Italy, or your Nero di Avola from Sicily, you're gonna get a good balance there.
Cool. All right. We again, because we're not this is not a video facing thing, but just quickly, one of the things that I've also found that detracts people from trying wine is that there seems to be a ritual around drinking wine. So, like, you know, the swirling and the sniffing and the legs and all of that stuff. What do you think, Jenna? So we wouldn't go into all of that, but what do you think? Do you think that's like, how important do you think that is in terms of experiencing wine?
I mean, none of it is important, right? The whole process for me when I started, which for me was great because I didn't have to bow to any of those pressures, is that I wanted to develop a very systematic way of distinguishing what I'm drinking. Mm. You know, it's because then you can distinguish quality, right? You can tell what is good and what is not. All you're drinking when you drink wine, because there's so much variety of it, is that you're building institutional memory, right?
Okay.
Just so you know what you're drinking, so just forget everything else. When I started, I had so much Merlot at once. I had Cabernet, I could tell this was not Merlot. And that was all I was interested in. Okay. And I got good at telling the difference between Merlot.
Yeah.
And it's important because this is how we, later I learned that this is how we become experts in wine. I mean, you can tell when a wine is corked because you know what it's supposed to taste like, right? Mm. If you told me you picked the Merlot from France and you picked the Merlot from South Africa, I can tell you the difference because I know what a Merlot from tastes like. So that's how really we are on that. Beyond that, none of the other stuff matters. All of that is relatively objective, how the legs, how long it is, all of that. Just enjoy your wine. If you don't want to participate in that, don't, right? It's not necessary
for you to
enjoy the wine.
Yeah, that's good to know. That's really good to know. Okay, so what's next for the Africa Wine Club and for you in wine? You've spoken a little bit about creating your own label.
Yes.
So if you want to talk a little bit more about that, and then anything else that you have down the pipeline in terms of what you're working on.
Yeah, for me, it's been an exciting journey trying to build my own brand within the wine space. Obviously, knowing very well what our people like. So creating that for the masses, for your even for the people who buy a lot of wine, your Monday night wine, your Tuesday night wine. This is not your weekend wine, right? This is not your the regular day wine is what I'm producing that allows people to drink what is predictable and approachable. So that's been good. I'm looking forward to the delivery of my first batch, which is about 2,000 bottles. And then after that, another 2,000 bottles of one that is slightly higher end. All these wines I've tasted here and had other people taste, and the response has been good. So it's just developing, for Africa Wine Club, for me personally, developing that, having events, figuring out what people like, what they want more of. Once we develop the Accra branch a little bit, being able to go into Lagos, being able to go into Maputo, being able to go to other African cities, Lusaka, Nairobi, and have this group that would be a group of Africans who command respect on their knowledge of wine and influence. And, all that becomes important in being respected in the wine space. Right now, when I tell people the kind of volumes I bring in, they're shocked. But yeah, we consume a lot because we are very social people. We want to be able to be recognized for that, not just as consumers, but as producers.
That's great.
I want to own a vineyard in Italy that produces wine just for Africa. So that's the goal.
That's amazing. Yeah, that's amazing. And as you were speaking, I was thinking of two potential sort of other opportunities in terms of the things you're doing. One, I think there's also opportunity to do it in the diaspora, right? So you can find a lot of groups in, starting in the big cities like New York and the DC area, even Atlanta, where you have concentrations of diasporans, Africans in the diaspora.
Absolutely. That's a great idea. And that's really the goal. And that's why it's not African. It's
right.
So
yeah.
Who's everybody who has any kind of African blood? We should be everybody really in the world.
Yeah. And not to put you on the spot too, but one of the things that I'm working on is a restaurant in Accra, which we haven't fully opened yet. But one of the things that we want to do as part of our programming also is to educate people on wine.
Yeah.
I'm particularly interested in pairing with our food. So I think, because like you said, we do a lot of our stuff socially around food and drink. And so once people start to get comfortable with that, I think that also tends to increase the pie of the market, if you will. For
absolutely. And I tend to work with everybody. You know, I've had people reach out to me, and you know, at the end of the day, we just want to grow. It's one of these things where it's meant to be shared. It's not meant to be, you know, the preserve of a certain group,
right?
So we want to grow it. And you know, even if you're a regular middle of the road Ghanaian or African and you only have wine at an event that you attend, or at a wedding or something where you need paper, the hope is that for you that experience is great, even if you can't afford it with your own money. That's our goal.
Yeah, great. Okay, so before we transition to rapid fire, let people know, I think you've mentioned it a little bit, but where they can find you online, on social media, your handles, etc.
Yeah, so that's it. I'm Wine Kodjo. It's Wine KODJO on Instagram. That's like mostly where I am.
And okay. Yeah, and I will include that in the show notes so that people can also easily click on that to find you. Okay, so let's do rapid fire quick. This is gonna take less than a minute. So just your first inclinations, thoughts, whatever. First one is red or white wine?
Both.
I kind of figured you'd say that based on the explanations that you gave before. Okay. Coffee or tea?
Tea.
Surprising given your Italian connections, I thought it would be.
There's
more
no wine, there's no coffee in Italy, right? It's all inherited, right?
That's true. That's true. The whole espresso culture, yeah.
Exactly. But yeah, I mean, tea because it's more variety and more nuance.
Yeah.
I say coffee too. I mean, I enjoy them both, but definitely tea over coffee.
Tea over coffee. Interesting. Sweet or salty?
Salty.
And then would you rather lose your sense of smell or taste?
They're connected scientifically.
I know, so you speak.
But if I had to taste, I have to have that one. So smell key.
Okay. And then lastly, if you could live on one dish for the rest of your life, what would that be?
It would be fufu and light soup, really.
Oh. Yeah. Not banku and okra soup.
Yeah, I had that so much that it lost the excitement, you know, lost the novelty.
Yeah.
My mother has that down to a science. We gave her that.
Cool. Well, this has been great. We've spoken over an hour now. I think people will find this. Before I got into wine, was extremely intimidated by it, and just all of the suggestions you brought up today was sort of how I got into it. Like I started to not care about all the swelling and the sniffing. I experimented a lot, and so as people who are thinking about, you know, getting, you know, tiptoeing into the wine space, especially in connection with our food, our local foods, our indigenous foods, I hope that this was helpful in sort of thinking about how you can approach wine in your eating adventures. So thank you, Kojo, for your time and for your expertise.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Item 13, an African food podcast. If you like the show, please subscribe, rate, and review us on your favorite podcast app. To keep up to date, follow us on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter at Item 13 Podcast. Item 13 is powered by Simplecast. Thank you for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a non-profit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Francis Lam, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.